So today we're going to be talking about permaculture and specifically what it is and how it is different to organic gardening. And for me particularly, one of the things I am really interested to know is how urban gardeners like me might be able to incorporate permaculture into their gardens at home. So I know very little about permaculture. I'm an organic gardener. And I have got Natalie here on the podcast today as my very first guest to share her experiences about permaculture and to tell us what it is and how we might be able to incorporate it into our suburban lifestyles. So I met Natalie through Instagram, and she is the wonderful person behind the Instagram handle Living the Dream Permaculture. So welcome, Natalie.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you very much for coming on. So let's start at the very beginning. And I think when I think of permaculture, I think of people living on big blocks with chickens and bees. So I was really interested to see how permaculture might be incorporated into an urban. Let's start by talking about where you live.
Okay, so I'm in West Gippsland in Victoria. I'm cool temperate in my climate, but I'm about 60 kilometres as a crow flies from Mount Baw Baw, which is an alpine mountain in Australia, and it gets snow there. So I'm also on the border of subalpine, so I can get quite cold where I am. I have cool summers. I've got high rainfall. I'm very lucky with that. We get about 1,300 mils a year annually of rainfall. And it can frost here. It can snow here, which is a rarity in Australian gardens. It doesn't stay on the ground for long, but it certainly comes, and it can be a bit of a challenge in the winter months. But other than that, I can grow all year round. It hasn't really limited me in what I can grow, and hasn't stopped me from eating from my garden year round either. I have 54 acres, so we're quite lucky, but we did move from an urban garden 3 years ago, so it's nearly 3 years on the dot, and we have just about everything here. We've got chickens and ducks and geese and pigs and cattle and sheep. And I have quite a big growing area. I have 750 square metres as an annual bed, which is where I grow most of my veggies. And I've got about 5 acres of orchard and food forest kind of area. So a little bit's in conversion, a little bit's traditional orchard, and then some of it's just a mix. We are quite hilly where we are, and we're surrounded by bush. So I think that kind of describes where I live and what it looks like, and some of the elements that I have to work with.
That sounds amazing. I am so envious of the size of your vegetable garden. I could just think of all the amazing things I would be growing if I had that much space. So how long have you actually been gardening?
My mum's always been a gardener, so I started off just following mum in the garden, watching what she did. But she was very much an ornamental gardener. We had a tiny veggie patch, and I learnt some basics of her. I then met my husband when I was 19. And we started dreaming of buying a farm together. And the dream of the farm, it wasn't necessarily what we're living now. It was just space for kids, and just a lifestyle kind of block. We then got married, and we travelled around Australia in a combi, and we stopped in at his old mate's place. My husband grew up in WA on 20 acres. And so while we were travelling, we stopped in to his friend's 100-acre farm, and they were living very self-sufficiently, out of necessity. The stores were, 40, 45 minutes away. So they'll do a monthly shop, and they would grow everything else. They grew all their own meat, all their own veggies, all their own eggs, and then they bought milk and bread, and they froze it, and then everything else just in the pantry. And so we're there for a couple of weeks, and I really got to observe their lifestyle. I had always objected to eating homegrown meat. I never wanted to eat anything that I had ever met. But my husband had warded me up before we arrived and said, look, if you want to eat meat, you're going to be eating homegrown meat. So just did it. Pandemic of us, basically. And so I was part of the process. It was really difficult, but it opened my eyes to a different way of living, and it really intrigued me and changed my opinions on home-raised meat. I also saw the huge veggie garden, which was amazing. And this guy had taught me about GMO seeds, heirloom seeds, and what was happening in industrialized agriculture. And so that was really an eye-opener for me. That was a spark. That was what I needed to come home and start gardening. So we had a couple of months left of our trip, and we came home and we got back into our house. So we had renters in our house while we were traveling. And we were in quite a hilly, so foothills, Dandenong Ranges, Western Slope, which is really difficult. Australia, you don't want it to be a Western Slope. It's probably one of the hardest places to garden. But being a new gardener, not having studied permaculture yet, I had no idea. And my garden got only a couple of hours of sun a day. I could not garden in winter. And it was full of gum trees, so they sucked up all the moisture, all their roots invaded my growing space. And I didn't really have much luck, but it was a start. And I had started, you know, my seed collection, I started learning and how to grow from seed and that sort of stuff. A couple of years later, we sold up and we moved to another suburban Melbourne block, but it was flat. It was north-facing by mistake, but it was north-facing. And one of the first things that I did was start gardening in my front yard. So we knew the backyard needed to be a space for the kids and for the dogs, and I really wanted to get growing, because the point of us buying that suburban block was to renovate it so we could sell it and so we could buy a farm, because the farm was still on the radar. So yeah, one of the first things I did was grow in the front yard, and it was really that foundation to get me where I am now. So 6 years later, we sold that property and we bought our farm. And I got growing straight away here as well. I was really excited. I knew I wanted to live self-sufficiently. And we had a little veggie patch here that I could start in. And then we just started working on expanding. So we added another 700 square meters through that winter and spring so I could get started growing in the summer. And again, I wasn't very successful, but, you know, there is a story behind that that I'll get to. I was growing in subsoil. When we created our veggie patch, we cut into our slope and got rid of all the topsoil to flatten it out. So I had a clean slate, basically, but it wasn't an easy clean slate because there was nothing to grow in. But it was all part of the learning process. So it was a really long explanation on how I came to gardening, but it was just a seed that someone had planted. I just kept researching it and trialing it and growing to where I am now, where I can live off the land. I can feed my family. We've got a family of five and we can eat from our garden year round.
That's amazing. And I think most gardeners have a similar story in that it's a very small seed that gets planted and then it grows over time. You become more and more interested. You get more excited. Your vegetable garden expands. But most of us have not expanded to the extent you have. But it sounds very exciting being out on such a big property. And as I said before, I'm just so jealous of the size of your vegetable garden. I just think of all the things I could do there. So can you please tell us what permaculture is?
It's different for everyone, but basically permaculture means permanent agriculture. But how you apply that is so unique. It's unique to your situation, to the person. But basically, in the whole scheme of things, it's a holistic system. It's looking at everything. It's making an efficient use of space and infrastructure and your inputs. So that tree that you're planting, what can it give you than just food? Is there other things that it can give you? Is it shade, habit, and all that sort of stuff? It's also about design and research. So for a permie, research is like 3/4 of the work. Thinking about it, looking at your aspect, thinking about how other things can impact it, like wind or water runoff, how it's orientated, how you stack your plants, why you're growing certain things, why you're growing them next to each other. So it's really looking at each individual unit that you're putting in, making sure that when you're going to place it somewhere, you're placing it there for the long run. You're not just going to plant a lemon tree in a boggy spot and then go, oh, I shouldn't have planted that there because lemon trees hate wet feet. You could potentially kill the tree and lose the money. You're also losing the time and the resource of that tree. So It really is a lot of thinking and researching and observing your natural environment around you.
It's quite amazing. I'm just trying to absorb that and compare it to... So I'm trying to absorb what you've said and compare it to what I am doing at home. And I guess I can understand your using your lemon tree example, but certainly when I came in to our house and we first built it, I was just dumping things in everywhere and wasn't thinking about, well, I certainly never researched what that tree might actually need in order to be sustainable. So I wanted to say about fertilizing. So in a permaculture garden, would you be, for example, buying a bag of blood and bone and adding it to the soil?
Yeah, I think that's a very personal thing. Like how I had someone kind of almost have a go at me on one of my posts where I was using a power tool. He's like, I don't use power tools. It pollutes the environment and the noise. And I was like, well, when you've got 54 acres, sometimes you need to use a power tool. And are you using a car? And, you know, where do you draw the line? For me, yes, I use blood and bone, probably not as much as maybe someone else would, but I've got really poor soil here. I garden on silt. It's incredibly acidic and it binds up all the nutrients in the soil. And it's not very nutritious to begin with. So I need to add blood and bone at the moment and I don't produce my own. So I do buy it in, but I make sure that the ones that I buy in is a traditional variety. There's a lot of blood and bone, especially from the big hardware stores that have a lot of urea and inorganic components in it. So I'm very fussy with my blood and bone. There's only one brand that I'll use.
Right, okay.
And then things like, you know, like lime, because my paddocks are really acidic, then yes, we would use something like lime to remedy that. So definitely it's not... fertilizer and amendments are not frowned upon. It's, I suppose, it's making sure that they are organic and natural, because something like the urea that's in blood and bone from big box stores, that's, you know, that kills all your microbes and your worms don't like it either. So that's not looking at the system as a whole. But if you're grabbing blood and bone, that's just blood and bone. There's microbes in there. It's feeding the soil life and it's feeding the worms. So that is something that I would be happy to use.
Right, okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. I saw a really interesting photo, I think it was just on Google, which was organic gardening versus permaculture. And the photo of the organic garden was the house and the grass and the veggie patch and some flowers. And the photo of the permaculture garden was the house surrounded by trees and there was a pond and there were bushes and it really did look like it was its own little ecosystem. And from what you're telling me, that seems to be the big difference between what I am doing, which is having a vegetable garden and growing vegetables and trying to be self-sufficient to vegetables, versus permaculture, which is more about being one with nature, I suppose, and creating this ecosystem within your backyard. So if I was interested in trying to incorporate some simple permaculture ideology and techniques into my urban garden, and it's great that you started in suburbia because you've been there, you haven't always been on a farm, so this is good, you can relate. Where would you start?
I would start with a plan. This is what I do for my urban designs when I design properties for people living in suburbia. I would observe where the sun path goes. And so permies often say, take a year off to observe the land because things happen through the year. The sun changes on the axis. It's lower in winter, so you don't get the full sun like you do in summer. I had a property that I was designing for that had a 3-meter embankment. And in winter, there was a section of the garden that got no sun at all, and she was hoping to plant her veggie patch there. And I was able to show her that where she was going to put her shed was the only spot that would get a decent amount of sun in winter to be able to grow in. And so that maybe if we thought about changing where the shed was and putting it where it was all winter long, that we could put the shed there, it's out of sight, and put the veggie patch where she'd walk right out her back door and it would be in full sun and she'd be able to grow and be successful growing. That's probably the first place that I start is tracking where your sun goes, especially in winter. In summer, you're going to get sun basically anywhere in your garden all day long. It's just the sun's much higher and it can kind of come through with the trees and buildings and stuff. It doesn't get blocked so much. But if you're wanting to grow veggies in winter, then it's really important for you to track that sun. And, you know, permaculture, where do we start? Do we start in the garden or the house? You know, composting. Composting is a fantastic way to add life to your garden. And recycling the nutrients from your garden and your home and bringing it back to your veggie patch to continue to grow nutritious food. I've got a grow once bed. I'm going to use that as an example. It's a really large area and I use large animals in it, but we can swap my large animals out for smaller animals. So I've got 300 square meters where I only grow pumpkins. It's really hard to maintain such large areas weed-wise, and this area is particularly pressured by kakuyu grass or runner grass. And so what I do there is, in a permaculture system, is I run my pigs in there. So I'll run them through there in winter, and they will eat up any of my old plant matter. They'll eat up all my weeds. They'll fertilize it. They'll turn it over. Can't have pigs in suburbia, obviously, but you can have chickens. So think about like a movable coop over a veggie patch, and you could move this over several veggie patches. They're going to do the same thing. They're going to clear your weeds. They're going to poop. They're going to scratch it up a little bit. And then I plant a cover crop of, say, peas. I inoculate my peas once, so I won't ever have to do this again, but I inoculated my peas with a symbiotic bacteria that fixes nitrogen onto the peas' roots. Just before they flower, so they capture nitrogen from the air and they fix it into your soil. Just before they flower, I chop and drop, and there's my mulch. You can do that much easier in suburbia. It's a really quick job on 300 square metres. So on a smaller garden bed of, say, 10 square metres, it's not so difficult. You could use broad beans. Any legumes are great. And then I plant my pumpkins in there straight away. You don't have to use pumpkins, but pumpkins is what I do in that area. And then I harvest them come autumn, and I start the process again. So that's a permaculture system that you could use in your own space, no matter how big or small it is. But it's multifunctional. I'm feeding my animals. I'm giving them an area to free range in. And then I'm growing biomass there. I'm growing my own mulch. I don't have to import it. I'm growing my own fertilizer. I don't have to put anything on there. And then I've got a harvest for myself. So, that's one of the most important things for me is a harvest, because I'm doing this and not doing this for anything other than to eat good, nutritious food and make a difference. I'm making a difference in my soil and making a difference in the environment, because I'm stepping away from, commercialized food. So there's so many flow-on effects, but the reason why I started doing this was food.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the reason I started doing growing vegetables down under was to give people the courage to grow in their backyard so that we were all collectively reducing our carbon footprint that is present through commercial farming. And if everyone grows a little bit, I mean, in suburbia, it's very difficult to be self-sufficient, but if we all grew a little bit, then that collective result would be the reduction of our carbon footprint.
You don't have to be self-sufficient in everything. You know, taking a step and being self-sufficient in something like herbs. Herbs have a whole lot of packaging on them, and you often don't need a whole bunch of whatever it is that you're buying. And greens is another one, because greens is in a whole lot of packaging and it doesn't need to be. And it goes really limp really quick. And how often do you chuck out half a bag or something?
Oh, I know, yeah.
It's walking out your back door and grabbing a handful or whatever you need. I think they're the two I always tell people to start with. If you can be self-sufficient in those, you can move to something else. And they're really easy, they're really cost-effective, and you can grow them year-round, most herbs year-round.
Yes, you're quite right. And in areas which are colder, You can bring a lot of those crops indoors and do them on windowsills as well. So if people are not wanting to garden outside, or if they're in balconies, yes, I think you're quite right. Herbs and leafy greens are a great place to start. And hard to fail. Like they are, they're easy to grow as well. There's something my kids like to grow. They like to regrow lettuces and things like that. So that's been incredibly helpful. So I wanted to just ask you three questions before we finish up tonight. And the first question is, what is your favorite vegetable to grow and why?
I think my favorite vegetable at the moment is cauliflower, because they're notoriously difficult to grow. I grow them really well, and it's taken me so long to be able to grow them well.
It's your victory plant.
And you can eat the whole plant. So, you know, cauliflower leaves are really amazing. And when we started our journey to being self-sufficient, I took a year where I challenged my family to only eat what we grew, foraged for, bartered for, or I sold my excess and we purchased things that I couldn't grow, like pantry staples, like spices and salts, vinegar and oil and all that sort of stuff. And we started at the beginning of spring, and I hadn't planned for it. I had given myself like 2 weeks' notice. So my garden certainly wasn't prepped for eating full time. So I had to become really creative. And one of the things that we got into was cauliflower leaves. Great in braises and soups and stews. The ribs taste like cauliflower, so they're really fat bit in between the leaf. Really delicious. And then the greens are like, you know, cabbage or kale.
Oh, delicious. So why are cauliflowers so hard to grow?
I'm not really sure.
It's just something everyone struggles with?
It's something everyone struggles with. I think it's got something to do with my soil here, because that's really the only thing, and slightly cooler where I am. That's only the thing that's really changed from my old garden. But I think they like it really nutritious. They don't like changes in soil wetness. Moisture.
They're a very high maintenance plant.
It's been a long day.
I have to admit, I do not grow cauliflower very well. I have not had great success. But I am from North Queensland, and so I tend to become a bit slack once June, July, and August are here, because it's just so bloody cold in Canberra that I don't want to be outside. And so I tend to slack off, and my brassicas don't get the love that they need. And I've always blamed that. But you telling me that you've had trouble growing cauliflower makes me feel better.
I think also a little bit of timing helps too. I get my brassicas in March because it is so cold here, and I think I'd be very similar to you in climate-wise.
Yes.
But I get my brassicas, long-growing brassicas in March. And a lot of people say, don't do that, it's too early. But no, when you've got a short growing season like we do, they need those 6 weeks of warmth that's left in, in the summer, early autumn. They need that to really take off, to have any sort of harvest through winter. Otherwise, you're looking at late spring.
Yeah, so I did get some brassicas in early enough this year, and I will get a winter harvest from those. And the rest of them, like you said, they're going to be a spring harvest, because I was replacing some of my garden beds with wicking beds, and they just went in too late. But that's okay. I'll have a delicious batch of brassicas come spring. And as it's the same for you in the Gippsland, you know, we are still quite cool here, especially overnight through September and October. So hopefully we'll be able to eat them all before they go to flower. Just as a side note, while we're speaking of plants going to flower and going to seed, do you let your plants go to flower and to seed so that you essentially get free plants coming up next year? Or do you try to harvest those seeds so that you can follow like a crop rotation cycle?
I absolutely save my own seeds. So I'm on a new journey now of seed saving. I had been quite complacent for quite a long time. I specifically grew heirloom seeds so I could save seeds, but I hadn't got there yet. And then COVID-19 happened and you couldn't get seeds. So I've really dedicated my time to learning how to save my own seeds, so I've got seed security and food security. And so, yes, I do allow my plants to go to flower, not just for the seeds, but for the beneficial insects that they attract. So it's that permaculture thing happening again. It's bringing the pollinators in, it's feeding my bees. And I generally save the seed. If I can, I'll get there to save the seed. Sometimes they'll drop and I'll have some stuff self-feeding everywhere, which I let happen and I let them grow, and they often do better than things that I plant intentionally.
I find that too. I guess it's because the plant has sprouted in at the perfect time, in the perfect conditions that seed was designed to sprout in, and that's why they do so well when they self-seed. But it does make it difficult if you're trying to follow a crop rotation cycle when you've got celery coming up where your celery were last year, when you're trying to move those leafy crops on.
Yeah, I don't really crop rotate much. I'm under the belief, and a lot of people would differ, and people probably won't agree with me, and that's fine. But I figure and I feel that if you've got really healthy soil full of microbes, that they kind of take care of all the nasty stuff. So I've never had an issue. And I chop and drop my spent plants too and let them, you know, decompose where they are, and I'll grow tomatoes again in the same spot, which is really frowned upon by a lot of people. But I've never had an issue. Maybe in 5 years, maybe in 10 years' time I will. But from stuff that I've read, if you've got healthy, good, it's like gut health. If you've got good microbes there, if you've got good nematodes in your soil, they kind of take care of all the bad ones. They put them in check.
So is not following a crop rotation cycle a Natalie thing, or is that a permaculture thing?
That's a me thing.
Okay, all right, just so that I understand that. But that's really interesting, because I would love the idea of just letting things go to flower and go to seed and come up again next year, because it takes so much of the effort out of trying to plant seeds, raise your own seeds and so forth. And so many people these days are time poor, and so letting nature just do its own thing is something I've always wanted to do. But at the same time, I am trying to incorporate a crop rotation cycle if I could. So it's very interesting that you don't do that, and I've now got to go away and study more about soil health and see if I can understand that a bit more, because as you said at the very beginning, gardening is a constant learning thing. You are constantly researching and learning.
Permaculture really focuses on perennials, and in a perennial garden you don't rotate anything. So coming back to that, maybe some of it is a permaculture thing. I've got perennial leeks and onions that I grow in one area, and I don't ever dig them up and move them somewhere else because I'm worried about something happening in the soil. So potentially,
it's
part permaculture.
When you say you have perennial leeks, does that mean that instead of harvesting the whole leek, you chop it off at the base and leave the roots in the ground to regrow?
It's actually a special type of leek that's a multiplying leek, so it will kind of grow offsets. Some annual leeks do that too. They'll grow like an offset if they go to flower too early. But these ones are, they're just like a multiplying onion, but a leek instead. So you can either dig them up and divide them. I've got like a really fat one that I'm going to harvest soon, and then I'll just, when I pull it out to harvest it, I'll probably just separate the 10 babies that are growing around it and expand my leek garden.
That sounds amazing. I did not actually know that they existed. So now I'm going to have to go away and Google perennial leeks too, because I'm all for that. So this has been incredible, because you've just sort of taken a weight off my shoulders, and I've now got to look into improving the soil health and seeing if I can be more perennial, because I only have 2 children and that is enough to occupy my time. But I would love to make the vegetable garden more self-sufficient. And it sounds for me that one of the big things about permaculture is that by letting nature kind of take over, the garden is becoming a bit more self-sufficient, whereas my vegetable garden is definitely man-made and man-controlled. So question number 2 is, what is a mistake that you think vegetable gardeners make, and how can they fix that?
I think the biggest mistake that I see time and time again is not mulching.
Oh, I say the same thing. Good.
Washing is so beneficial for so many reasons. It feeds your microbes. It keeps them alive. They don't like to dry out. They don't like to be exposed to light. It retains moisture, so you don't have to water as often. And it reduces your weed pressure. So I weed maybe twice a year, and I put that all down to mulch. I put a really thick layer of mulch on, and I've noticed in places that either it's not as thick, or that it's kind of blown away a bit, or it's kind of really started to decompose, that I do get the weeds starting to push through.
No, that's wonderful. I too am big on mulching, and I constantly tell people to mulch, and I don't really have a weed issue in my backyard. I am fortunate. One of the benefits of being in suburbia is that as long as you sort of keep the grass and the other area of your garden quite weeded and don't let weeds go to seed, that they're not blowing around. I imagine out where you are that, of course, you can't control weeds blowing in, but this goes to show that even in an open area like you're living, that you can actually control weeds if you are mulching. And so how thick would you say your layer of mulch is?
It depends what I can get my hand on, but ideally I like to put it on 15 centimetres, if not thicker, depending. And if I put it on thicker, I will kind of put a layer of mulch underneath my hot compost, and then I'll put a layer of hot compost on about 5 centimetres thick, and then another 15 centimetre layer of straw, which is my mulch of choice because it's what I can get easily here.
Okay, so you've planted your lettuce. Can you just explain to me where the mulch is in relation to the top of the lettuce?
Okay, so my lettuce I'll usually direct sow, and what I'll do if I did the straw compost straw layer, I would pull back the straw a little bit and plant it directly into the hot compost layer, and the roots, they love the straw, and they just go through the straw and into the soil underneath, and quickly break it down into beautiful soil. And so, yeah, so into the hot compost layer is where I plant my seedlings or my soil blocks or my seeds. If I'm planting something bigger like a tomato, I will pull back all layers of straw and then plant it into the soil underneath, so I can kind of plant it deeper without actually planting it deeper. Mm.
So you're not – so the lettuce is not kind of buried in amongst the straw?
No.
No, it's definitely up, okay. No, sounds great. I think I need to go and thicken my mulch now. I mean, I use Lucerne mulch because it's what I can get organically, and unfortunately I do buy it from a nursery. And I do about 2 to 3 centimetres, but now I feel like I'm not only going to have to go and research things, I have to go out and put an extra layer of mulch on my garden, because I thought I was a thick mulcher, but you are definitely doing better than me.
I'm coming from, like I said originally, we cut into the land a little bit to get a flat area because we're in a 30 degree slope. So I had no topsoil. And so I really had to build it up over the 3 years I've been here. And I've got a beautiful thick humus at the moment, which I continually add to. It's a never ending process. But if I had had topsoil, if I had really beautiful soil, I probably wouldn't pay as much attention on my really thick, well, I would really thickly mulch, but I wouldn't put the extra layer of mulch down the bottom because I wouldn't need to add organic matter to my soil. Mm. But I do. So that's one of my strategies.
That sounds great. Okay, last question is, what is your hot tip or trade secret for vegetable gardeners?
This one is something I learned last year. So last year I did my PDC, 147 hours. So it's permaculture design and permaculture skills certificate. And one of the things that I learned was the difference between hot and cold composting. I never knew there was a difference.
No, I don't know there is a difference. I'm about to learn something.
So I'd always cold composted my whole entire life. And that was, you know, a compost bin, and you add your veggie scraps to it as you get it. And I never thought about carbon. I only put in my wet ingredients, my nitrogen ingredients. And that was okay. It did okay. I couldn't make much compost, but we started hot composting. So people do it so many different ways, but for me, it needs to be quick and easy. And so I build it all at once, and it's about a cubic meter in size at a time. And I make about 4 for my growing area. And basically you're putting the right amount of nitrogen and carbon in so you can heat it up. You want it to get to about 60 degrees to 65 degrees Celsius. No, not too much hotter. It kills all the weed seeds in it, but it introduces all the beneficial microbes into your hot compost, which you're then spreading in your garden, which are the things that create fertility in your soil. But yeah, hot compost is a huge subject. I'm not sure how much I can and touch on that today, but I just layer it up. I use hay because we produce our own hay here as my carbon input, and then we collect 3,500 litres of food waste from one supermarket a week. And so I use that as some of my nitrogen as well as manures. We get free horse manure from around the corner. So, I just layer that up in a way that will create heat. You need moisture in there too. You need air. So there's a whole lot of in-depth stuff. But I think there are better people to explain that than me. But hot composting changed my garden from mediocre to amazing. I noticed a huge difference in plant health, abundance in harvests. It's been amazing.
Right, so another thing for me to go away and Google is hot composting. I always talk about my compost. So I had the in-ground, in-garden bed composting system, which I love because I can put everything into it. So what doesn't go to the chickens goes into the compots. And I have previously had bokashis and worms and tumble bins, and I have moved them on in favour of these compots, partly from space and partly from convenience. But now I'm going to have to go and Google hot composting and see if I can go and fit that in my backyard.
Well, composting is amazing because you can get a compost pile ready in 8 weeks, 8 weeks in spring, maybe 12 weeks in winter, even in a cool winter like that we get. But yeah, it's fantastic. You don't get any, like I said, no weed seeds, and that all the weed seeds from my hay gets, burnt up, I guess. And the fertility that's added to my garden has been astounding.
Gosh, it sounds incredible. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today as my very first guest and explaining to me permaculture and now keeping me up till midnight while I Google all these amazing things that you've told me about. So thank you very, very much. Now, just to recap, your Instagram handle is Living the Dream Permaculture with a few underscores. So I will put that into the description of this podcast episode so that people can start following you on Instagram, because I love watching what you're doing every day. I saw today you were posting about your seed collection. So I know that you're definitely a seed saver. It's something I'm starting to learn about too. So people can follow you and get more of this permaculture advice and knowledge direct from the source. And you have your own podcast as well.
I do. I had taken a little bit of a break because preserving season got away from me. Like I said, we had amazing abundance from just adding hot compost to our garden. So I had to then process that all into food that we could eat through winter. But yes, I'll be getting back onto the podcast. I have a blog as well. And we have a YouTube channel, which I sporadically post on too.
Gosh, so many places that people can access your information. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it.